whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Hi, I'm Karen Bennett. I'm professor of philosophy and chair of the Rutgers Philosophy Department. I primarily work in metaphysics. Some of my work more in the past than now, but some of my work is in philosophy of mind. So in philosophy of mind, I'm interested in questions about whether physicalism is true, how we can decide whether physicalism is true, what it even means to say that physicalism is true, how we should think about the relation between, you know, psychological explanations of our actions, saying that I performed some action because of my beliefs and desires, and saying that, you know, I did certain things because of some neurochemical stuff going on in my brain. And that last kind of question, it's really a question about sort of higher level processes and ways of describing what's going on and lower level processes. And that's really, I've done a bunch of things in metaphysics, but one of the things that's kind of driven a lot of my work has been thinking about the connection between sort of macro level and micro level states of affairs and making sense of how you get less fundamental things out of more fundamental things, whether the less fundamental things are the existence of tables and chairs or the existence of mental states. So a couple of years ago, I wrote a book in which I basically took on this project of thinking about the cluster of relations whereby you get less fundamental things out of more fundamental things, what those relations have in common, what we should think about this talk of some things being more fundamental than others at all. So that's in some ways, you know, the main, most abstract way of, you know, gesturing at the kinds of things that I work on.
Well, I think you've already answered or started to answer one of the follow-ups I was going to ask, because looking at your work in metaphysics and the philosophy of mind, I feel like to the non-professional philosopher, the mind-body problem is easy to be gripped by, easy to kind of feel the force of something puzzling there. And by contrast, questions about grounding, which are currently fashionable in metaphysics, can seem like kind of abstract puzzles. And the sort of question I was going to ask is about, you know, what the interest of them is. And I take it part of the interest of those questions about grounding, sort of abstract questions in metaphysics, is that they shed light on the mind-body problem. I mean, do you have more to say about whether they're interesting in themselves? Or is this sort of ultimately, do you feel like all this work is, in the end, the point of it is to unravel puzzles in the philosophy of mind?
Well, no, I think they're interesting in their own right. I did open the sketch of my work that way, partly just biographically, that's how I got into metaphysics. I started out being interested in philosophy of mind, and then I realized that some of the questions I was interested in philosophy of mind were really more general questions in metaphysics, and then I had to, you know, sort out some metaphysics to answer them. So I'll come back to grounding in a second, but just, again, speaking sort of autobiographically, I realized that certain questions about the relationship between mental states and physical states turned out to really be basically the same as certain questions about material constitution and the relation between statues and the lumps of clay that make them up. And I needed to think about those sorts of puzzles, and I needed to think about how to make sense of talk of things having modal properties, and, you know, they could be this way or they could have been in this other way, and, you know, if the statue could have survived a slight change in shape, or the mental state could have been the very same mental state if it was underwritten by slightly different neural firings and so forth. So I personally got into metaphysics through philosophy of mind. So just as a question of my personal history, but I absolutely think that these metaphysical questions are of broader concern. I think a couple of things. I think that while it's true that some of the work in metaphysics on the nitty gritty of exactly how grounding works does get, you know, you get into the weeds. And that's something that happens, I think, in a lot of subdisciplines of philosophy. And so it's not just something to point a finger at metaphysicians about, that's, you know, some of the details of how the debates go get a little bit, you know, inside baseball. But I mean, I think the same thing happens in the sciences, right? If in some big picture sense, what that those people in the chemistry department are doing is trying to figure out, or in molecular biology or what have you, in some sense, what they're trying to figure out is how life works or something like that. But if you talk to some particular researcher, it turns out they work on one particular protein and how it folds, you know? And so there is this kind of hyper-specialization that happens. So that's all just to say, yes, some of the literature on grounding does get inside baseball, but that happens in a lot of other disciplines as well. The other thing I wanted to say is that I guess if you're looking at some of the details of the debates, it can look sort of fussy or something. But I would say that when I was working on my book, I had the most luck explaining what I was working on to random people on airplanes than I've had throughout my career. Because I would just say to the person sitting next to me in seat 34B or whatever, you know, because if they asked me what I worked on, you know, I'd give some lead up to this. But then I would say something like, well, you know, that soda can on your tray table, do you think it's made of atoms, right? And they were like, yeah. And then I would say, well, do you think the atoms are kind of more basic pieces of reality than the soda can is? They're sort of more fundamental than the soda can, atoms in general. And they would say, yeah. And then I would say, well, what does that even mean? What does it mean to say they're more basic than the soda can? And then they would sort of look at me and then they would say, wow, that's really interesting.
I feel like we should move on to question one, but I'm not going to yet because I want to ask a follow-up, which is that seems like a very happy experience with strangers asking you about philosophy. did it ever go badly? Did anyone ever say, I can't believe you're paid to do this?
I've never had anyone say that. I mean, one expects that, you know, and those of us that work at public institutions that are funded by, you know, the state government, you occasionally wonder whether people are going to realize, you know, that state money is going to pay our salaries and so forth. But that's never actually happened to me. The kind of bad experiences I've had on airplanes, and I know a lot of people have had these, and not just on airplanes, but just talking to non-philosophers about what we do. The way the conversation goes awry is when they have this kind of misunderstanding of what philosophy is. Or they'll just say like, oh, have you ever read this person? And, you know, this person is just someone who's not a philosopher at all. Or they start asking about psychology or something like that. I don't know. But I've never really had someone be like, wow, what a pointless crock of shit that is. Which is what I think lots of us worry that they would ask us. But I've never had that experience.
I am glad to hear that. That's good. That's good. So I'm going to ask you an Iris Murdoch question that I always start with. She begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but she also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I don't think, or at least it's not obvious to me, that there's a direct connection between my temperament, my personality, and this particular views I endorse or the substance of what I argue for. I feel like with some philosophers, you could make that connection, you know, with people with a taste for desert landscapes who also say, like to keep their house very, very tidy or something like that. I don't see that direct connection, but I don't know that I would. I mean, it would be interesting for a third party who knows me personally and knows my work to try to make that connection. I do, though, think that there is a connection between my personality and how I go about doing philosophy, or at least my style as a writer. So when I say how, I don't mean, you know, the procedure whereby I eventually wind up with a written thing, but the sort of stylistically how my philosophy comes across on the written page. Because I feel like I have a more of a sense than some people of when I don't understand something. That's not to say that I'm never wrong and I think I understand something and then I realize I've gotten it all wrong. Of course, I make mistakes, but I definitely have this kind of visceral sense of I have no idea what these people are talking about. And I don't mean that in a kind of false, humble way where, you know, sometimes people, like I can think of a particular philosopher who's sort of known for claiming he has no idea what the people are talking about, but really what he's doing is trying to raise an objection and claim that what they're talking about is garbage. I don't mean that. I don't mean that. I mean, I have a fairly visceral sense of when I just don't understand what a person is saying or what the view is or something like that. And I find that in my right, when I do philosophy, whether it's in front of a classroom or on the written page, I think one of the things that is sort of notable about me is I try to be extremely clear and in a pretty conversational way. And I feel like I don't always succeed, of course, but I feel like that's something that's coming from my temperament more generally.
That's really interesting. I mean, I'm not going to ask you to name names on the philosopher who pretends not to understand things, but if I had to guess, I would guess they were British, just because I think of that as a particularly British mode of philosophical interaction. But on the being clear, do you also feel like you're willing, maybe this is more about teaching than it is about writing, to share confusion, to sort of to evince confusion and sort of invite people into it as a way to do philosophy?
I think I do now. I don't know that I would have been willing to do that in, say, the first 5, 6, 8 years of my career. And that is to say postgraduate school. I don't think I would have done it in graduate school. So I guess what I'm saying is that when I was younger and at a more vulnerable stage of my career, I would have been much more likely to hide the failure to understand. In fact, here's an anecdote. I remember when I was in graduate school, there was a person in my class, and when he spoke, I never understood what he was talking about. But I was convinced that the problem was me. I thought, you know, he knows what he's talking about, right? I mean, I'm just stupid or something. And then it turned out that apparently he just wasn't very good and he was asked to leave the program. And I had no idea, you know, I completely believed the problem was me. But of course, as I got older, sort of gained my philosophical chops, also gained more confidence in my philosophical chops, you know, that changes. And so now I will, absolutely. I don't know that I necessarily do it in front of an intro class, but I certainly do it in reading groups and so forth with graduate students, absolutely. And in more upper level classes, yes. In graduate seminars, I'll, you know, be confronted with a paragraph and, you know, does anybody know what's going on here? Somehow they started at A and got to B, and I don't see how that's supposed to go. And I find that that's a very useful thing because sometimes somebody else can explain it to me. And other times, turns out nobody has any idea how that was supposed to go. And so then we can try out, well, maybe they're thinking this, maybe they're thinking that, you know, how would this go? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's also in a way empowering because it, to the students who are feeling confused, to see a professor who's evidently brilliant evince confusion is sort of makes you feel less of a fraud in your own confusion. Like I was thinking back to you as a student feeling that way and what it would have been like if the professor had said, I'm not sure I really understand what's going on here. And I definitely find it one of the pleasures of feeling less defensive and a bit more established is feeling like I don't have to perform mastery quite as much or don't feel the need to impress people in that way as much, which is very liberating. And I think better for just doing philosophy, I think.
I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. I mean, it's better personally. I mean, it feels good to not feel like you, I like that phrase of performing mastery, to feel like you don't have to prove yourself all the time. But I completely agree that it's good for philosophy in terms of what comes out of the conversation. And it's absolutely good for the students. Yeah. And I think that it's, you know, it's not just me that does this. You know, one of the things that I participate in frequently here at Rutgers is a reading group where a number of us faculty do that. And I think it's a really good, because, you know, we're just reading stuff and sometimes we've never read this particular paper before. And I think it's, you know, it's very good for the grad students to see that.
Well, I think there's a natural move here to question two. Is there a trait you wish you had more of as a philosopher?
Yeah, I wish I had more productivity. No, I feel like sometimes I wish that I had more ease with formalism and technical stuff. But that said, it's sort of a double-edged sword in that I don't value technical stuff for the sake of technical stuff. And I'm certainly one of those people who occasionally reads papers and thinks, you're just doing that. You're just putting this in formalism because you can. Like, there's no obvious payoff to this. But I do sometimes wish that I had a little more ease and familiar. You know, it's not like I can't do the technical stuff, but I'm not one of these logic-y people to whom it comes as absolute second nature.
Did you ever make a kind of concerted effort to sort of practice formal technical things or could have changed that aspect of yourself? Or was it something that you just took in stride?
I mean, I've certainly done all the logic classes that everybody else has done. And I feel a little funny saying this about myself because I feel like I'm exposing an Achilles heel or something. It's more that it's not something that grabs my interest very much, you know? It's not that I'm in favor of doing philosophy sloppily. And as I say, I have done some quasi-technical stuff earlier in my career back when people did supervenience, you know, I have some sort of quasi-technical stuff on that, but it's not really where my heart lies, you know? And I guess I just kind of vacillate a little bit on the importance of super technical work. You may need to edit this out. I may be getting myself in trouble. But so I vacillate on the thought that I wish it was something that came more easily to me. And at the same time, I am sort of glad I'm not a logician, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things where it's useful, but there are risks that come with being sort of sucked into it too deeply, I guess.
Absolutely. As I said, I've definitely, you know, refereed papers where I thought, well, they're just doing this because they can, and there's no reason that this paper is as technical and unreadable as it is, you know.
I kind of think we may have already touched on two possible answers to the next question. So I was going to ask, I'm still going to ask, question three, what do you love or hate most about philosophy? And the technical, formal bent of a certain kind of metaphysics is one thing that is a kind of, a lot of people have a love-hate relationship. And grounding, for sure, is another object of love and hate amongst philosophers. But besides those two, is there something else that you really love or hate about philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to answer this. My inclination is to answer this question in a much more general way rather than sort of pointing at particular topics that bug me or anything. I think one of the things I love about philosophy is the fact that almost any question is fair game. And I mean that in kind of a couple of senses. One sense is that, you know, you can change tracks later in your career. You know, if I, you know, my career is largely based in my work in metaphysics, to some extent, philosophy of mind. But if I suddenly started getting interested in ethics, I mean, obviously I'd have to get myself up to speed and, you know, not just start spouting my opinions without getting, you know, meshed in the literature, but I could do that. Or I could realize, hey, there's this very interesting question about, you know, some political matter or something and take my work that direction. And that would be, I could do that in a way. I think it's easier to sort of change what interesting topics you're working on than it might be in some other academic fields. I also, and another sense in which any question is fair game is something that, I don't know, it's something I bring up when I teach intro. I'm teaching a big intro class again this semester, and we've just been wrapping up our unit on the existence of God. And, you know, you don't really answer those questions. It's not like you give a couple of lectures on the problem of evil and your students walk off feeling like they've solved it. But one of the things I try to impress upon them is that the importance of this is just seeing that this is a topic that you can have actual intellectual conversations about, that you don't just seal this off as a question that's not, you don't discuss people's religious beliefs, which is, you know, I think how a lot of people who aren't in philosophy think about those questions. And to see, you know, no, we can put this question on the table in front of us and start evaluating some arguments about it and really looking at this question, and that we're allowed to talk about this is something that I think is wonderful about philosophy. And as I say, I try to impress upon my intro students. So that's one thing I think is wonderful about philosophy, is this thought that kind of pretty much any question is fair game. The other thing I love about philosophy, and maybe my answer to this is sort of subfield specific and not specific to all of philosophy, but I actually really like the culture of philosophy. And I know that, and the culture of intellectual discussion. And I know there are people who would disagree with this and think that there's a lot of posturing and that philosophy is really hostile. That's not the case in my subfield, at least not now. I mean, maybe it was previously in the profession. But I'm in a part of philosophy where conferences, now that we're starting to go to conferences again, you know, there's a lot of legit intellectual exchange and paying attention to people's ideas and raising real objections, but then trying to help the person see how to solve those objections. For the most part, I mean, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. I mean, sometimes people are hostile. But when I think about talking to friends in other academic disciplines, I don't think that's always the case. I've talked to scientists who, you know, sort of presented as, well, you go and you present your research and then you leave. And there isn't really this kind of intellectual connection. Or I have a friend in an English department somewhere, and the sense I get from her is that, you know, you have to publish your book to get tenure, and you have to publish another book to get promoted to full. But they don't really read each other's books. You don't have the same kind of culture of, there's this book and we're going to have symposia in the journals and we're going to have sessions at the APA where we're going to really grapple with each other's ideas. I don't know. I may be talking out of school here because I'm no sociological expert on what goes on in these other fields, but it's just the sense I have that it's something special about philosophy, that we really engage with each other in a way that doesn't always happen.
It definitely has it's one of the advantages, I think, of philosophy being a small field, and of the fact that you don't have to write a book for tenure, is that people write books when they have a book to write, and the field is small enough, and it's not so overloaded with books that people do read each other's books. And even outside, I mean, this goes back to the changing fields. Like, people can still read outside of their own area of specialization in philosophy in a way that maybe not as much as they could 40 years ago, 30 years ago. I don't know. But certainly to a degree that's quite unusual for an academic discipline, I think.
Yeah, and you're right. I think maybe part of the explanation of it is exactly what you said, that we don't have to write books. So there are fewer books. I hadn't really thought about that, but that seems right.
It seems like a good thing. I mean, I'm going to put you on the spot with this question, which goes back to changing subfields in philosophy. So if you could pick a subfield of philosophy and overnight have read everything in the field, so you're no work required, you're fully up to speed. It's like, you know, Neo in the Matrix, plugging in and knowing Kung Fu. Is there a subfield that you think that will be the one I would pick if I was going to do something new?
That's super interesting. Off the cuff, I would say maybe some moral psychology. So not so much the branches of ethics where we're you know, thinking about Kantianism or utilitarianism, and not so much applied ethics, but the kind of stuff about moral emotions and stuff about not so much free will, but just the ways in which the structure of our beliefs and desires lead us to behave in certain ways, things like that.
I have to say, if you were going to give an answer on an Iris Murdoch inspired podcast, you couldn't have come up with a more of a crowd pleaser than moral psychology. So that's good.
And it's completely out of left field, given what I work on. It has like nothing to do with what I in fact work on.
But it's clearly fascinating. Yeah.
No, yes, it's fascinating, and it's one of the branches of philosophy that seems plugged into ordinary experience.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. Well, so having asked you if you weren't a philosopher of metaphysics and mind, what would you do? I'm going to ask you the bigger question. If you weren't a philosopher at all, what would you do instead?
Yeah, it's such a hard question. I think that if the question is about if you had made different choices back in the day before you got on this career path, what would you have done instead? I think the answer is probably that I would have been a high school English teacher. And I'm just thinking out loud here and finding this sort of revealed to me as I speak. What's sort of interesting about that is partly that it would be English rather than philosophy, but partly also that the thing that just immediately comes up is high school English teacher rather than English professor, you know, being an academic in an English department. That's what I always loved in high school. I almost was an English major in college. I think that the reason I'm saying high school rather than English professor is probably because I was interested in the stories and the narratives and how they're put together and how they happen, rather than some of the bigger quasi-philosophical questions about authorship and identity and so forth, those things that are sort of more of a issue in English departments in colleges these days. But I think that's what I would have done. I mean, I don't think I ever really had a moment when I would have done something that was radically different from being an academic. The intellectual life always seemed like sort of a safe life, you know? I remember when I was first applying to graduate school, my brother saying to me that I shouldn't go to graduate school straight away because I knew I was good at school and I should go see if I was good at anything else. I didn't take his advice, unfortunately. But I think the question of what I would have done had I made different choices way back then is interestingly different than the question of what would I do now?
Yes.
If I were to quit my job.
Well, what's the answer to that?
What's the answer to that? I don't know. Gosh, what would I do if I were to quit my job? And it's sort of a cousin of the question, what will I do when I retire? Although that's a different question because then you don't have to make money, hopefully. What would I do if I were to quit my job? I'm not quite sure what I would do. Part of me thinks that it would be interesting to work in a non-academic part of a university. You know, my career is really my research, but at the same time, what I often am doing on a day-to-day basis is educating 18 to 21-year-olds and, of course, graduate students. And I enjoy that. I realize this is an unfashionable thing to say. I'm not supposed to like undergraduate teaching, but I do. And I'm interested in that sort of demographic of person. So perhaps I would be working in a university in a different context, or maybe I would open a catering business and sell baked goods. Who knows?
Well, there's also always the thought that if you quit your job, you just apply for a job somewhere else. I've often thought that about, you know, if I quit my job, I would apply to grad school in philosophy. That's the thing I would most like to do right now is go. I get so much out of it at this point. And also there's so much to learn. The field has moved on. It's like I would love to have
done. Yeah. I don't think I want to do grad school again. Yeah. Well, there are always those new direction fellowships, Kieran. I know
that they're very, yeah. The idea of starting over is always perennially appealing to me, but I'm gonna shift focus back to you and ask you the final question, beginning with another Murdoch quote. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher. She wrote, "What is she afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
What am I afraid of in the big picture sense of those things? I'm afraid of death. I'm afraid of fucking up my kid. I remember when I first had a child, I was very pleased that for the first couple of years, they're not going to remember anything you do, you know, if you drop them off the changing table, and as long as they're not hurt, you know, they're not going to remember it. But now I'm, you know, my kid is of an age where she's going to remember everything. And am I saying the right things when she's expressing anxiety about this or that? Do I raise my voice too much or, you know, et cetera? I'm afraid of missed opportunities and regrets. I'm afraid of being old and looking back and feeling like I did something, I didn't make the right choices or didn't take advantage of something. I think those are the biggest fears. And it's kind of, in thinking about this, it's kind of reassuring to realize that if I'm asked the question, what am I afraid of? Those sorts of things are the answers, those big things. And they all seem like reasonable things to be afraid of, to be honest. But when I'm going about my day-to-day life and something is making me anxious or I'm worrying about something, the day-to-day anxieties are usually about little stuff that doesn't matter at the end of the day. You know, the day-to-day anxieties are like, oh my God, can I get this done by Friday? You know,
yeah.
Or, you know, oh, did I forget to email that person? Or, ah, I forgot to do that. Those things that wake you up at 3 a.m. But those are not the things I'm going to reach towards when I try to answer the question about what I'm afraid of. So it's kind of nice to realize that those are not things that really matter. So this is better than therapy, Kieran.
Okay. Good. Well, with that moment of perspective, I'll say thank you, Karen, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Karen Bennett is professor of philosophy at Rutgers University and the author of Making Things Up. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions.